Welcome to episode 12 of the N3SP podcast, a production of the National Security Strategic Studies Partnership, or N3SP. Our guest today is Dr. Tom Mao, a retired Air Force officer and former member of the Air Force Academy faculty, who's been writing a book about his experience deployed to the Strategy Division in the Joint Multinational Force Headquarters in Iraq in the fall of 2004. Tom earned his PhD from The Ohio State University in political science with an emphasis on foreign policy decision-making, which, as I think you'll hear, was very relevant to the type of work he was asked to do in Iraq in 2004. So before we get into that, I'm obliged to offer the disclaimer. As with all episodes, the opinions and ideas of the speakers do not necessarily reflect the positions of any government organization, academic institution, or commercial entity, and should not be construed to do so. With that as a standard introduction, good morning and welcome, Tom.
Thank you, Darren. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you this morning.
So I thought we'd start out, as we often do, with a little bit of background about who you are, how you got into service in the Air Force national security field in particular, but then relevant to the manuscript you've been working on, how did you wind up in headed to Iraq 20 years ago, and then talk about your service there. And then the focus of your book is looking at this question of how we did strategy in 2004, which is a reminder for folks, very early in the campaign in Iraq, and what lessons are still relevant out of that experience, which probably pertain to today, or maybe historically you can say existed in other settings.
So I joined the Air Force through ROTC in the 80s through Notre Dame. The 80s were definitely a time where there seemed to be an awful lot of national security threats facing the country, and joining the military seemed really a patriotic thing to do. I went into as an engineer, computer engineer, ended up working most of my time in the Air Force in acquisition, in weapon system acquisition, particularly in safety engineering, and then more straight line program management in later times. And then along the way, I picked up a master's in international politics, found that I could teach the Air Force Academy. That seemed like a good idea. They sent me to graduate school. That seemed like a good idea. They brought me back eventually. All this seemed like great ideas. And it really was. It was a great time. But when I got to 2004, I was kind of restless in a lot of areas of my life. Just an email popped up basically saying the dean was asking, hey, the two-star in Iraq is looking for some volunteers to go to Baghdad and advise on strategy. And I thought, hey, well, sure, that sounds like a great idea. Let's go do that. Part of being in the military is you feel like you're supposed to be in the military, wars and things like that. And in acquisition, all I was doing was things that were things civilians do. And I love civilians, but civilians do program management, civilians teach school. But having the opportunity to do something that's more directly serving the national security interests of the U.S. was just an opportunity I wanted to take.
And in this instance, again, you describe a call that goes out to Air Force Academy faculty members from time to time whenever there are overseas operations that say, hey, here's an opportunity. Here's a staff that needs some particular expertise. Sometimes it's just a general, shall we say, a levy that Office X needs someone to fill this role. Yours was a more specific request for a staff that filtered its way to, particularly, I think, the interest of folks in a couple of departments, political science being one, to say we want someone to work on this staff on these types of questions. And unlike a traditional military unit where you would deploy a squadron of fighters over to the Middle East or to Asia in response to a threat, there's no corollary strategy unit that sends a unit of people over who are just the strategists, that's what they do day in and day out, because that's done at certain headquarters levels with the A staff or the J staff, depending on what service or overall level you're working at. But it's not as deliberate as deploying hardware. So I think in having talked about where your book is going, it's going to be interesting to hear those personal stories of how did the services, because this was a joint program, find talent and try and pull talent together and then use it to have an impact on early conflict that you were part of. That's itself kind of an interesting setup to what the story is I think you're going to tell here in a bit. Let's dive in to your story. You arrived when in 2004? When and where?
I arrived at Baghdad International Airport on Friday the 13th of August. I remember that because Friday the 13th seemed like a very auspicious day to be on the ground in Baghdad. And within a few minutes of arrival, I knew that I had got myself into more than I was bargaining for. The enemy hit a fuel farm on the about half a mile from us with some kind of indirect fire, blew up some tanks, and big pillar of smoke's in the sky. And I'm thinking, I thought this was supposed to be, this was billed as sort of, go to headquarters. Headquarters has got to be safe, right? You know, you're doing some, you know, paperwork or something like that. I don't think that it quite sunk in until we were arriving in Baghdad. Well, it started seeping in a little bit before that, that no, we were actually, you know, really embedded in the green zone, in the center of a hostile city where we were going to be under fire a lot more often than Air Force people normally are. To put that for context, this is 2004. So this is long before the surge, long before any of that kind of stuff. This is just the second year of the U.S. occupation of Iraq. And we had just restored Iraqi sovereignty. There's an Iraqi interim government that had been formed. And we now were trying to staff up how to get Iraq to its set of elections that were going to be happening over the course of 2005. And so that was the context of this, is what might those elections be, and what will that mean for U.S. policy in the area, for our force structure and things like that.
I was going to ask, so what were the first problems that were pitched to your division's area of expertise, what we asked to try and wrestle with?
Right. Good. You know, that's great. This is where things get sort of odd. There's three of us from the Air Force Academy. And we are not there on a deployment. That's an important factor. This, we were there on what in the military is called a drug deal. One general asked another general to send some people. We were basically on TDY orders. We didn't have transportation arranged through any stage of this. We had to call and get a ride in from the airport and wait for space available flights and things like that to get to Baghdad. So when we got to headquarters, we didn't have obviously assigned role. But my initial position was sent over to the policy area, where I guess my main portfolio, so to speak, was working on militia disarmament, on advising the Iraqi committee that was supposed to figure out how to convince some of the militias to disarm and reintegrate into Iraqi society. Other militias were just supposed to stop fighting and they were the enemy. So they had this categorization between good militias, bad militias, and militias we weren't entirely sure whether they were good militias or bad militias, and what to do with these people who were well-armed and understandably not terribly trusting in the end of the process. So I worked on that for about 3 weeks, and then they decided to reorganize the office. And instead of me going with the militia's office to where it now goes, because I had been brought over in a drug deal by a particular two-star, I had to stay in his office. And so that's the point when I got reassigned over into the strategy office. And the militias, somebody else started over from scratch on the militias issue.
So what portfolio did you get assigned after that reorganization?
My primary job that I was given by the colonel that I worked for, I'll call him Colonel Vortex here. I named the book after him. The book's called The Vortex. My main job was supposed to be what is going to happen in the Iraqi election, the upcoming election scheduled for near the end of the year, and what does that mean for U.S. forces? But I was constantly being diverted over into other side quests on doing this, starting with within a couple of days of arriving. The question was, which Iraqi city should the U.S., or the coalition, but it's basically the U.S., should the coalition conduct a kinetic operation in during the latter part of the year? You understand that my background has absolutely nothing to do with identifying what would be a good city to attack. So I had to kind of figure this out. And I reached the same conclusion that a couple of other people had on this, which was that the worst option that probably the best option is not to do this at all, because it wasn't clear what good it would do. And if we were going to do it, we should do it very soon before Ramadan begins and keep it far away from the elections. And that the worst option for doing this would be to go into Fallujah. I mean, this was the same conclusion that my two predecessors had received. And it was rather, in language that is not suitable for a family-friendly podcast, that conclusion was rejected by the colonel that, no, it's going to be Fallujah. And basically, it seems like my secret task was I was supposed to provide some argument for why Fallujah would be a good idea, because it seemed that that had already been the decision that had been made. So I got diverted onto that. Then I was assigned to lead a interagency review of our campaign plan. Again, I'm now in the strategy office for less than 2 weeks, and I'm organizing this review of the campaign plan, which, to my surprise, the campaign plan that we had only been created in July. So a year after we invaded Iraq is when we had a developed campaign plan, and it was not very good. It wasn't very precise. So now, only 2 months later, we were now essentially revising it, not officially, but basically more or less, what are the key decisive points and decision points towards reaching our desired end state for Iraq? And all signs at the end of this pointed towards we need to have an election process and a series of elections, but especially the first election, that the Iraqi people regard as having been legitimate, and that everything that we do ought to be organized around making sure that election works, that that's more important than security on its own. Security efforts should support the success of that election. Economic efforts should support all the lines of operation should be focused on what ultimately is basically a political aspect, which is having that election come off as scheduled in a way that the Iraqi people accept. And that would, it's kind of the only route towards turning the enemy's center of gravity, which is, you know, who does the population support? The government will put in place and us, or do they support the people who are opposing us? The only way to get that center of gravity to shift into support for an Iraqi government and one that we support is through that election. So that became what I was working on.
And the security situation there, given the presence of militias, as you mentioned earlier, made it problematic to have any safe election where people weren't probably fearing for life and limb by going to the polls, correct?
Yes, yes. The election turned out much better than we thought. We actually, we figured like 1,000 people, you know, a huge number of people would be killed. And the election turned out to be much better than we hoped, although we did decide that whatever happened would declare the election a success. we never published any real metrics on what would be a successful election. The militias that we're talking about, the good militias were ones that were all, every party in the interim government had its own militia, and they were the good militias. And some of them were a communist militia. Some of them were an Iranian-backed militia. Some of them were a Muslim Brotherhood militia. And these were the good militias, understand, that we had. And they were okay. But it was all the, you know, whether it's former Ba'athist regime members, whether it's supporters of Al-Qaeda, whether it's supporters of monotheism and jihad in Iraq. These are, well, not really what we call militias. They're more just insurgency or resistance forces. Although that there was a key thing to understand was that, are they an insurgency against the kind of regime we're trying to install in Iraq, or are they a resistance against their occupation? And that was something that was difficult to get our heads around.
Different layers at that question, right? I mean, who are they fighting? It's also probably useful to tell people that in most parts of the world, political movements have the political component that we recognize as a political party, but they may hear in the news people use the term armed wing of. And it's not uncommon. I think you can look at Lebanese politics since the 75 civil war and even until today. A lot of parties have an armed wing that sort of take things outside the political arena when what's going on in the political arena isn't satisfactory to that group's interests. So that's not a very Western approach to things, but that is something that find in a lot of areas outside the United States and Europe and whatever we construe as being West.
Yeah, it's less common in the Western countries than it used to be. But things, for example, the Sinn Féin and the relations of Sinn Féin and the Irish Republican Army in Northern Ireland, not all that long ago, really would be one example of that kind of thing.
Ideally, and again, in an ideal world, the expectation hopefully was that the struggles over shaping the future of Iraq would then move into the political sphere and out of the streets, where you have a collision of militia on militia through force.
Yes, yes, exactly. And as we were thinking about this early, what the post-election could be like, and this was a mistake I made on the timing, was sort of a thought that post-election, we're probably going to end up with about the same amount of violence in Iraq, no matter what happens, because some people are going to be left out of the elected government. And we were initially at least indifferent about whether it would be some of the Shia, Muqtada al-Sadr's group, and some of the Sunni are disaffected. They're still fighting us kind of at some level across the entire country, or we end up in a situation where the Shias are very happy with the results of the election, and we really are, you know, more or less, the south of Iraq becomes fairly quiet, but we have a more intense level of conflict in the northern part. We were sort of indifferent to that, and I think that was a mistake. The result of the election turned the war into more of a sectarian conflict than it had been before. When I was there, it was very much of a broad-based people in different parts of the Arab communities of Iraq. And I'll leave the Kurds out of this, because the Kurds are fairly happy with how things were going for the most part, as long as they had their militia, and they were not going to give it up. That kind of everybody across Iraq was more or less not liking the U.S. and the way things were going. By concentrating things, that kind of crystallized the war eventually by 2006 into the real civil war between Shia and Sunnis that broke out at that point, and probably is what really broke Iraq at that point. But the reason that happened was because of the type of government that ends up getting elected. You know, as we're looking at in the fall, we're not sure what we want. We're kicking around various ideas. For example, there was an idea that given that it seemed like the Iraqi people were very opposed to the idea that the U.S. was in Iraq and their main opposition to the current government was that the government was appeasing the Americans, and that is a British idea initially to announce that, hey, you know, U.S. is planning on leaving Iraq in, say, 2007, like in 3 years or something like that, that we're going to that's our plan to do this. And that would counter the Iraqi idea that we're going to stay in Iraq forever. And we would insist we don't do that. We don't occupy countries forever. And the response back from Iraqis would be things like, well, how long after World War II are you planning on leaving Germany or Japan or Italy? And we're like, well, but that's different. How about Korea? When are you going to stop occupying Korea? Like, well, that's different, right? But they didn't see it that way. They saw it as U.S. invades countries, puts forces there, and they never leave. So we threw this idea out there, but we couldn't come up with a, it seemed like, well, maybe that would help the current government, but wasn't clear if we really wanted to help the current government. Maybe it's a bad idea. Maybe it'd be better if the Iraqis elected an entirely different government. And so it kind of got bounced out largely for partisan reasons that we got word back from Washington that anything like this would go against the presidential election campaign. So that was a non-starter. But at that point, we still didn't know what we preferred. Now, as we got closer to November and I'm developing this election model and kind of like Nate Silver before there was a Nate Silver, I had a model with demographic turnouts and supports for different groups and things like that, realized that it really was important that the Sunni Arab population participated in this election and that we end up with a government that was more or less similar to the one we had installed, because that government would probably institute things like federalism. It probably would institute a better plan for demobilizing militias and a number of other areas where we realized actually those results after the election would be much better than if we end up with the government we got, which was a coalition of more or less religious Shia Arabs and the Kurds, and excluded the Sunni Arabs from politics. Now, the Sunni Arabs sort of excluded themselves by boycotting the election. And at the same time, things like the invasion of Fallujah, things like a raid on Abu Hanifa Mosque in North Baghdad, other things also drove the Sunni Arabs away from it. So at the same time, my last thing I'm working on is what we called a Sunni engagement strategy, which was how can we do things to try to bring the Sunni Arabs into the political process better, while at the same time, you know, so the kind of the headquarters, the four-star level, but the three-star level where, you know, the actual fighting forces are doing all the things that we're saying are not good ideas to do, because we're saying, well, we have to do these things for security. And so on the one hand, we had a strategy we were developing for what we thought would be a good idea, but we were not executing that strategy because short-term security imperatives were overriding the longer-term political strategic imperatives.
So let's talk a bit about the decision process within this division. Talked about that previously in introducing where we were going to go with this conversation. But how many people did you have in this division after that early reorganization? What's a day look like amongst this team?
A day looks like what we call Baghdad time, where something would happen and you'd be like, hey, remember when this happened? And be like, oh yeah, that was earlier this morning. Oh yeah, it seems like so long ago. Probably a day was basically in the office pretty much 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. with some breaks for, you know, grabbing a meal. So certainly long hours. There are probably, I think it was about a dozen to 15 people or so in the strategy office for quite a long time. It seemed to kind of expand, but we all seemed to have our own tasks we were working on and not working all that much with each other. We had somebody who's working on lessons of counterinsurgency. We have somebody who's working on the legal implications. You have somebody who's working on psychology of the Iraqi people. And all of this is getting filtered up to our colonel. Part of why we call them Colonel Vortex is that then mysterious things happened that were invisible to us. Things would go to the vortex, and sometimes it'd go to the two-star, sometimes it'd go to the commander, sometimes it'd pop back out for more work. So it wasn't always clear to us exactly what happened beyond our current tasks. The only time we really got together was every morning, 9 a.m. or so, we'd all get together for what the colonel called morning prayers, where we would basically deliver progress reports, a stand-up meeting, and new taskers and things like that. But for the large part, it was focusing on our own things. Over time, the strategy office, when I got there initially, was largely reservists and various people who were just sort of army people who had been assigned a strategy because they were on a deployment rotation, and that's where they ended up. Some of them, and there's variations. Some of them had definitely some skills in this area. Others seemed to like, what were they doing? It wasn't clear what they were doing. And so our two-star who called us over, I guess, identified this as being an issue and started bringing over people with doctorates from the military colleges, from the academies. And then the colonel actually started then bringing people over on his own. He got permission to like bring over people from Naval Postgraduate School, from West Point. Ultimately, even though some of us were on deployment orders, we started calling ourselves the Doctors Without Orders, because we were just this group of PhD holders and JD holders who really had no special expertise in this particular area, other than that, I guess we were supposed to be smart enough to figure out what was going on and offer advice that would go up the chain to the commander eventually.
But because you understood political decision making, you had JDs, that was lawyers. You had, I think, an economist over there. So you had a representative sample of expertise in the various elements of, let's just call it international power. People have their different 4, 5 or whatever letters from dime on upwards for diplomatic, informational, military, economic influence. So it sounds like you had a team that was rightly composed of those expert areas. The challenge, it sounds like, from what you described, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that integrating those perspectives, which you think is kind of the function of an overall strategy, wasn't as deliberate, as effective as you might have thought it to be, because everyone had their individual task and that went up. At what point did integration occur, if not within a strategy unit?
I think it occurred within the unit, but it seemed like an awful lot of it happened at the 06 level and above. And as an action officer, I was rarely involved in those. I was involved in some of them. We had something called the Council of Colonels, which I briefed at a couple of times. And there was another time where they convened what they called the Smart Guys Group. And that was on the withdrawal thing, which was, I thought that was telling in and of itself, that within 2 days we could get, basically there was a group of people within the palace that they identified, these are the smart guys and we can get them all together within a couple of days and do this. It says a lot about everybody else, I suppose, what they thought of them. But it wasn't always clear where this integration happened. Things would happen at a great pace, and then a month and a half later you think something's over and it turns out it's coming back for further review. A problem we had was time, that we have the hard deadline of the Iraqi elections coming up. We have the deadline of the American elections coming up. Unfortunately, that was also an influence on this, and rotation of people in and out. And so just seemed like always wishing we had been able to have done something earlier. We were wishing we had figured out something when it was still early enough that it might have made a difference. That was one of the key problems, was just this the lack of time to do a good job and the lack of real deep expertise in this. You've mentioned my background. A little more detail on that, though. I was a specialist in European Union NATO relations. I'd also done a lot of work with Latin America and things like that. I knew nothing about the Middle East. I didn't have any subject matter knowledge. I was figuring out as it was going along. Same thing was true of the economist. I had lots of information, but he was a Middle Eastern specialist. The historian, who did know a lot about the Middle East, he was put in charge of assessment, which was not really his main area either. And he organized this. So you mentioned, you asked about how assessment works. They had 100 different items that they were briefing regularly on success and progress on these things. And it was just so many different items to try to understand, and what did they mean, that just ended up being very unclear. Like the question of the availability of electricity, and I say, well, it was 30%, and it was never clear. Does that mean 30% of the country had electricity all day, or all the country had it 30% of the day? Or it was just still throwing these numbers out there that I wasn't deeply engaged in the assessment side of things, but it seemed to me from the outside that assessment was so complicated it actually made it more difficult to make decisions and understand what was happening. It was almost too much information, perhaps.
Which sounds to be very typical of the modern environment, as we have the ability to bring in more and more information. It just overwhelms people. That's the attraction of, air quotes, artificial intelligence, to be able to sort through piles of information. But perhaps as a future conversation on this podcast might address, there's problems with that expectation, because you spend a lot of time teaching the algorithm what you want and thereby may exclude things that you need to know, but you essentially programmed out. When we were talking earlier before we started recording, you mentioned some of the challenges on a staff like this is dealing with contrary opinions and
yes,
the necessity of doing that to have a good strategy, to be the devil's advocate or whatever. How did you see that working in your your particular unit?
Well, Darren, it started really very early there with the Fallujah question, where it became very clear that this was not the right answer. And again, it's a family podcast, so I can't but understand that the colonel was not a family-friendly speaker, that this was the wrong answer, and I was a bad and stupid person for having come up with this answer. And this would happen over and over again, where a pushback on, why are we doing this? How does this make sense? Would be met with a torrent of shouts and profanity that really discouraged even bringing these kinds of things up. And all of us, I think, but I guess I can only speak for certain for myself, would find ourselves like, well, this is what I really think, but I'm going to kind of couch the election outcomes. I mean, I know that I had a failure of imagination just how badly this election could come out. I did not imagine that the Sunni Arab boycott could be as effective as it turned out to be. But I ignored that. But even to the extent I thought it could be, I was like, well, I'm not going to present that as a possible outcome because no one's going to want to hear that. They're not going to accept that. And then they'll reject everything else I'm saying. So I'm kind of easing up the worst case scenario into not quite as bad as I really think it could be. And I think that then continues as it goes up the chain of command. Everybody's saying, well, my boss isn't going to want to hear that really worst case scenario, so I'm going to make the worst case scenario not quite as bad as it was. And by the time it gets up to the commander, this is what I suspect that happened with the Afghan withdrawal, is that by the time it gets to the actual decision makers, they're no longer privy to what the action officers really think might happen. And what they think might happen is still filtered by their own limitations on my line. I shy away from that possibility because I didn't want to think about that kind of thing. You know, as another example, eventually I realized I might as well, you only live once, I might as well stop being quite as passive. There was a plan in late November. I mentioned the Abu Hanifa raid, which was pretty stupid. We had a plan to raid the headquarters of the Muslim Ulema Council, arrest its spokesperson. And also, by the way, we were going to break our ceasefire with the Sadr organization, arrest a couple of his people. There's no particular why. It's not like he doesn't have other lieutenants. It's not like other people can't speak for the Ulema Council. And I went all over the palace to find why this is a really bad idea for our plans and all this. And the raids did not happen. I don't really know exactly how much I had to do with that not happening, but I think it helped a little bit. But I got called out as somebody who was helping me. We had a kind of get together at Thanksgiving out of the parade grounds, and the two stars going around kind of saying, hey, there's so-and-so. Yeah, hey, God, this is weird. So we're like, we all know each other. We all know who we are. And he's like, hey, there's Colonel so-and-so, the gloomy Brit, and there's Tom, his silent sidekick. And like, what the hell? I mean, that's so gratuitous. It's absolutely unnecessary. Well, the point is unnecessary to point me out at all. I mean, I'm a major. Like, who cares that I'm there? But he wants to identify this British guy here who's in charge of campaign plans. He's gloomy. He's a gloomy person. And Tom, he's also a gloomy person. We don't want gloomy people around here. And I wasn't nearly as gloomy as I needed to be. But that kind of thing just creates this bias towards positivity, towards success. Nobody wants to hear that, something? I don't know if there's any good way this can work out. All we have is a whole lot of bad options here, and we've got to pick the last bad one. Everyone wants to hear, no, how are we going to win? How are we going to win? Everyone wants to know, how's this going to work? And I doubt that has changed much, because that's how bureaucracies, that's how the military works. We're biased towards success, right? We're going to win. We're going to win. We don't plan just how to lose in the least bad way.
I think that's probably a cultural thing, not only the military, but the U.S. in particular, committing to that. It's not a bad thing, but that cultural commitment and focus does bias discussions, as you just sketched out, to exclude things that might say, well, if we do this, we won't win. Well, you can't just reject that. You take it, look at it, and fix that problem to get back on track to, well, how are you going to win? And culture,
yes.
That cultural focus we were talking about earlier, that seems to be something that, even though people change, the turnover for personnel in a deployed environment is usually measured thing from past 6 months to maybe at most, 2 years? What were the longest serving folks you had on the ground there?
I don't know there's anybody I was serving with in the military side who'd been there more than a few months. I guess Colonel Vortex was a holdover from General Sanchez's period, as I think was the two-star, but most of us had been there for a very short amount of time, and we're going to be there for a very short amount of time. By the way, remember, we also are under fire a lot. There is sort of we're in a headquarters planning unit, and I don't know what people envision a headquarters planning unit looks like. I know what I envision it looks like. I envision it as a fairly safe, calm place with lots of work going on. I was not envisioned as a place where we're under indirect fire on an almost daily basis. And that does add to the stress of doing your work when you're in that situation. I realize we're not a forward deployed unit that is under direct fire constantly, but it was a very odd situation, I think, for a headquarters having to be under fire constantly.
Certainly in history, those weren't the conditions that, say, planners in World War II were necessarily under in the UK if they weren't in London. Although reading historical attacks, V1 buzz bomb attacks, maybe that is a common theme that people have to deal with. But the short-term nature of it goes back to what we were talking about. The cultural component is probably what explains the continuity of that approach. As people churn out, why do you keep doing things in the same fashion? People have changed. What is the constant? And that it's probably some degree of cultural organizational memory, I put in air quotes, that preserves patterns of behavior even though the individual people and their personalities rotate out on a 6-month to maximum 12-month rotation, right?
It is, and to a certain extent, you're thinking about what are you going to do next. You're also looking at promotion possibilities. I know I was twice passed over. One of my motivations for going, besides wanting to feel like I'd been in the military, but part of it was, well, let's throw the dice on a long shot of getting above the zone promotion. If anything could do that, going and serving in the strategy office in wartime headquarters, that might work. That kind of motivation for other people, hey, this will give me that below the zone promotion that I've been looking for. And so pleasing the boss becomes as important as doing the right thing if they come into conflict, as just sort of a natural psychological thing. We're humans. You made a great point about sort of how we frame things. It kind of goes back to the foreign policy decision making. I know way back to my first assignment the problem was not basically, there's still a lot of violence going on in northern Iraq. Would it be a good idea to launch a kinetic operation before the election? That would have been one way to frame the question, but that's not how the question was framed. The question was, where should we launch this? The assumption that we should do this had already been made, but by framing the question in that way, you direct certain types of answers and you exclude other answers from the range of possibilities of what's considered acceptable. So right there is, what can we do about this rather than can we do anything about this? With the possibility being, no, we really can't. We just kind of like, this sucks. Can we do anything about this? No, this is terrible. We just have to live with it for a few more months.
I'll pick up where you were going there. In essence, you've got the same basic dilemma as the political party militia faction. Where do you operate purely within the political sphere? And then where do you decide that politics is not going to be the solution? We have to use force in the streets.
Yes.
It sounds like the challenge is, well, how do you know, what's the connection? How do you know you're going to be effective if you move out of politics and pick up the sword, that you're going to have an impact back on politics, which is where you want to put the struggle eventually, is to get people back into a non-kinetic environment. So how much kinetic is necessary to produce a non-kinetic steady state?
Wow, that's a really deep question, Darren.
Well, for the next podcast, we'll pick up there. But that's the dilemma, right? But nobody knows that.
But it is that dilemma between when you launch an operation. When I talked about Fallujah, I mentioned a few times, specifically, what happened in the Fallujah thing? And there's a whole lot of stories that have been written about it, and they're mostly written from the perspective of either people who are justifying their decision or people who are there on the ground in the drama of fighting it. But the actual impact of Fallujah was, we telegraphed it so long ahead of time that all the people that were really important to get rid of had left Fallujah long before. They were off in other areas. As soon as we went into Fallujah, violence erupted all across Iraq. In Mosul, they were capturing police. When Islamic State was going to Mosul, this is giving me flashbacks to what happened after Fallujah, because we had diverted so much of our forces into Fallujah that we had left a vacuum in Bakuba, Mosul, in Baghdad, and elsewhere. And so police stations are being overrun, Iraqi army facilities are being overrun, weapons are being stolen, uniforms are being stolen, all kinds of things that are going to be incredibly useful for the bad guys while we're out there killing some bomb makers and some people who want to become martyrs, who are very dangerous people to go after. And the refugees from Fallujah, because we did this just towards the end of Ramadan, so now as we enter the high holy days of the end of Ramadan towards Eid, all these refugees from Fallujah are pouring into Baghdad and becoming more visible to the Sunni population there. The Iraqi news, as everyone is gathering for their fast-breaking meals at the end of the day, all the news is about what the Americans are doing in Fallujah. And whatever advantage there was to killing some bomb makers in Fallujah was offset by the political damage done to the Iraqi people's views view of the Americans and of the incumbent moderate government that had more or less authorized this operation to happen. So when you're saying how many kinetic operations, like probably some in cases, but you have to be careful not to just create more opposition to yourself in the short term than you're blocking. That's what the Fallujah operation did, is it created more hostility and then laid the groundwork then for the disaster of having the Sunni Arabs not represented in the Iraqi political process after the election. And so they felt if a group clearly identified and relatively cohesive group feels like we have no role in this society does not represent our interests, we did not participate in it, we are not part of this constitution, they are likely to rebel against it and take up arms against it. And that's when they were already doing that to some extent, but they did it to an even greater extent afterwards. And so the appeals of Zarqawi's group and al-Qaeda's, well, by that time they had merged and become affiliates of each other's, but their call for resistance and armed rebellion became much more compelling to the average Sunni Arab after all this happened. How many people do you have to kill to bring peace? Probably some, sometimes, but you got to be real careful and think about what are the consequences. And that's where maybe the deepest lesson I would see from this is a failure to plan for the next day, the next week, the next month, the next year. And we see this in wars that are ongoing today where somebody does something, and I guess if it works out fine quickly, maybe that is good, but the consequences turn out to not be so good for them, and they don't really have a plan for how to move forward at that point. And then maybe it would have been better not to have done it in the first place. And that's, I think, maybe the biggest lesson of strategy in Iraq, was not planning for the future if things don't work out exactly the way we hope they will.
So planning for alternative outcomes.
Remembering that the enemy gets a vote. You know, there's a Schwarzkopf line, which I don't remember exactly, is basically like, well, you know, the enemy will come in contact with our plan. It's like, and that worked out very well. And the Desert Storm was done very, very well up until, it's getting off subject, but up until the helicopters were allowed to continue flying and all of that. But we did not understand the enemy's motivation or their different motivations. You know, assertions were, well, they're terrorists. We can't negotiate with terrorists. And it was, they're our enemy. They're the enemy. Their job is to, basically their job is to shoot at us. I mean, that is their job. We can't, you know, we can't hate them for shooting at us. We have to accept that that's shooting at them too. Sort of this outrage that Americans would tend to feel, that how dare they be shooting at us? Well, it's a war. That's what people do in wars.
The big question is, at what point is there a pivot, a transition from that group is the enemy? For the sake of whatever future we're going to build, we're going to have to transition to bringing them into a political process, including their more radical elements, but recognizing that you're not going to bring, you mentioned it earlier, the Germans or the Japanese back into a condition where they can govern themselves, then you are basically setting yourself up for perpetual occupation. Knowing whom you can trust and how you restart, cold start a political process that takes the fight out of political exchange, that's hard. Hard in Western Europe. We did it notionally better there and in Japan, but that exists wherever you have conflict and you try and transition into the peace phase. And that muddy middle is something that we don't really have a good theory for or practice for. We just made it work.
Yes, agree.
We could go on about this. You're writing an entire book on this. We're trying here in this discussion to get a little bit of insight into some of that, and hopefully people will look for that book when it comes out, and publishers will look for it, I think, at this phase, and want to say that this is not just an individual story of combat because you were under indirect fire, and it's not a general's level story, but this is the sort of an insight into the central process by which these decisions get made from a really interesting perspective. So anything else from that perspective you want to share, and then we'll wrap up with the usual transitional question.
Covers it pretty well, Darren. You're exactly right. This is that sort of the messy level of how strategic decisions really end up getting framed, and all the, you know, kind of the way it really works at a level that might even be invisible to the commanders, I suppose. they may not. That'd be interesting. I hadn't thought about that, but I wonder if a commander reads it, it's like, really, that's what was going on down at that office? Because I guess there's no, just as we didn't know what was going on in General Casey's office, I imagine he didn't really know what was going on down in our office either. I never thought about that before, but pretty messy.
You're basically being treated as a black box, right? You know, there's a strategy cell, send instructions down, get stuff back, but what goes on inside the black box is not apparent to anyone. I would almost say, and probably going to have someone talk about more experiences with AI in the future, but you are more or less an analog AI, right? You've got expertise, and you're trying to manage a vast amount of information, And you're being conditioned, as you described earlier, by the feedback you get from senior leadership to exclude some things or draw more on certain resources. That's what happens at the digital artificial intelligence environment. You were simply doing that as an analog level 20 years ago. I'm sure someone out there is going to hate that analogy, but let's come on the podcast and debate it.
No, I like the analogy because also one of the most terrifying things there was that I knew I really didn't know what I was talking about in some areas, but I had to present it with complete confidence as well, because no one else knew anything more than that. Sort of the moral terror of, I know more about this than anybody else, and I don't know anywhere near enough to really be able to make a good decision, and yet people are going to make decisions based on what I say. So that sort of faulty AI of coming up with answers that are confidently and convincingly wrong. Oops. Yes. I was an analog AI. I could, that could be a good, I like that.
All right, well, we'll see where that goes in the future. But for now, let's pivot away from talking about your experience in the past. And let me put you the question for the future. In the next 5 years, what change or trend in international or domestic politics, economics, law, technology, or even culture will have the greatest impact on national security, in your opinion?
Yeah, and your mention of AI is actually a great transition to that, because I think AI is going to be accelerating what I see as the biggest, and what I see as the kind of a problem right now. Elliot Cohen actually put something at theatlantic.com just this past Sunday called "The Awfulness of War Can't Be Avoided," that touches on the same kinds of things I've been thinking about, which is sort of this, call it fundamentalism, call it optimism, call it idealism. I've been thinking a lot about E.H. Carr's 20-year crisis lately, and how people in many countries around the world, in all sides of the politics, seem to be less and less wanting to address the actual ground truth of reality, possibly even at the extremes denying that reality even exists, that it's all constructed or something like that. But that people say, they kind of make up their own set of facts that this is what I think is happening, and insisting that it is true and demanding that the world conform to the way they want it to be, which really does not work very well. But what AI is doing is, I think, making it easier and easier to avoid contact with reality. You know, communication trends in general, this has already started, but it's becoming easier and easier to create a whole set of facts that are not actually true to back up what one wants to say and convince other people of what you think. And ultimately, you get the idea that, well, we can launch this attack on this country and it will all be okay because of this and that. Or we can launch this counterattack and it will all be okay because of this or that. Or we could ignore dealing with this problem because, well, I have all these facts out there that say that it doesn't have to be really a problem. And so one effect of AI is that it's, well, three, kind of three effects. One is this, that it just makes it easier for people to avoid dealing with actual reality. A second is the economic disruption it's going to be causing as people, as it does start, I think, replacing jobs in ways that are going to be much different than what happened in the Industrial Revolution, as it's going to start kind of concentrating wealth to a greater degree. And the third is what it's going to do to the actual content of warfare, as we are seeing signs that countries are using AI technologies for targeting decisions and things like that. But given its weaknesses, they're making target decisions that perhaps are not wise. But the reaction cycle on that is going to be quicker and quicker. I certainly, Ukraine is not exactly a naval power, and granted, Russia isn't really either, but with what Ukraine has been able to do, the Russian Black Sea Fleet, I worry, what's the fate of the U.S. Navy in a conflict in the Pacific? Are we really prepared for that kind of thing? You know, are we hitting a phase of a new revolution in military affairs, to use a concept your listeners are no doubt familiar with, that we don't really appreciate quite yet. So that's where I think it kind of, these different impacts of artificial intelligence and how that's going to affect kind of cultural realities, how it's going to affect economics, but also how it's going to affect the conduct of warfare.
Well, we could take that as an entire episode for a podcast to discuss, because that's fascinating unto itself. But I'll have to draw a line there for now and maybe have you back. We can tangle with that question. Thanks again, Tom, for being part of this discussion. And thanks everyone who's now listening to what is episode 12 of this N3SP podcast series. We hope you've enjoyed hearing about this experience from 20 years ago, but which is relevant, I think, timeless in many respects for how decisions are made in the conduct of war. You can think about how those apply to current conflicts, as we were starting to do there with the wrap-up on that question. Finally, stay tuned for future episodes. And in the meantime, if you'd like more information, please go to our website at n3sp.org. Thank you and goodbye.